This is Scott Berguin of KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We are now turning to back to the Philippines in the fourth of a four-part, maybe five-part series on what is going on in the Philippines. Today we're going to be talking to Joaquin Hui of the Philippine U.S. Solidarity Organization based in Seattle. Joaquin went to the Philippines last August and visited Surigao, among perhaps other things, but first let's say hello. Hello, Joaquin.
Hi, Scott.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, I appreciate having you because we're beginning to get talking with other folks that went on the International Solidarity Mission, beginning hopefully to get a fuller picture of what's going on in the Philippines. And so I know you did go to Surigao, but why don't you start with, let's say, an overview of your perspective on what is going on, what people need to know about the Philippines.
Okay, sure. So the thing about the Philippines that I think is really interesting, I mean, I actually am half Filipino, half Chinese, and so, of course, personally, I'm very interested in the Philippines, the history and the culture. But one thing that a lot of Americans don't realize, and I think don't understand, is that the Philippines has long been a colony of the United States. Back when it was in vogue to acquire colonies to become rich as a first world country, you know, such countries set the trend as Spain and as England and France, etc. You know, the United States realized that in order to compete globally, it had to also acquire colonies. And so the Philippines was one of those important colonies that it grabbed in the Philippines, in Asia. And so most people know that the Philippines was under the rule of Spain. And then during the Spanish-American War, the United States kind of got the Philippines as a gift or bought the Philippines from Spain for $20 million. And it wasn't just the Philippines they got for $20 million. It was also Cuba. I think it was Cuba, I think maybe Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines, all in the Treaty of Paris. And so that started the colonial history, the colonial relationship between the United States and the Philippines. And because of that, the United States has had a long influence on the country of the Philippines. And even though, and actually a lot of people also don't realize or also don't know, is that when the United States took over the Philippines, there was a very long, protracted war, which is now known as the Philippine-American War, and that was waged from 1899 to about 1913, 1914, and it was initially called the Philippine Insurrection, and basically it was a war of liberation. The Filipinos there, from the north to the south, were rebelling against the colonial rule of the United States. And it was also a very bloody war for the Philippines. Estimates from the generals, from the American generals on the ground, were that over 1 million Filipinos died. Mm. And, of course, that doesn't include the torture and the rape and the destruction of villages that was documented by the Red Cross and by other organizations there. But it was a very incredibly brutal war. And and after that, you know, after some years of colonial rule, where the United States had basically ruled the educational system, ruled the culture, and created an environment where the United States was the colonial master and that which should be desired by all Filipinos, you know, the United States supposedly granted the Philippines independence, and that was in 1946. So there was an official Philippine independence. Now, a lot of people point to this event and say, look, the Philippines got independence from the United States. Everything's great. But if you really look, you know, as we all know, things aren't always in black and white. If you really look at the fine letters, the small print, you'll see that there was a lot of strings attached in that agreement, specifically the Bell Trade Act of 1946, also known as the Philippine Trade Act. And that was passed by the United States Congress, and that was also enforced or forced upon the Philippines. And that had a lot of controversial provisions that basically tied the Philippines to the United States. So one was the peso, which is the monetary unit of the Philippines, that would be pegged to the U.S. dollar. The act also prohibited the Philippines from selling or manufacturing any products or goods that might come into any competition with the United States, right? So immediately this act says that the U.S. must be preferred, must be, the weight must be put upon the U.S. goods in terms of competition. So already in this race for lifting themselves up, they're already crippled. And then it also required that the Philippine Constitution would be revised to grant U.S. citizens and corporations equal access to Philippine minerals, forests, and other natural resources. So again, you know, it's like a colony. The United States has preferential treatment to getting minerals, to getting resources, and the Philippines, as many of your listeners hopefully know, has tons of natural resources, being a volcanic country. And then the Act also said that it also allowed the U.S. to import whatever goods it wanted with no duty. So there's no tax on any of the goods the U.S. could bring into the Philippines. Okay, so this merely crippled the Philippines in trying to compete economically and trying to advance itself economically. And this is unfortunately a condition which continues to this day. And another aspect of that I forgot to mention is there's this act which is in effect now, which has its roots in the independence of the Philippines, called the Visiting Forces Agreement, and that has its roots in the U.S.-Philippines Mutual Defense Treaty, and that was, I think, signed in 1951. Again, a couple of years after independence, and that basically said that the United States could use the Philippines land, to use bases in the Philippines, station its troops there, without any accountability to the Philippine government or the Philippine people. And one especially controversial aspect of the Visiting Forces Agreement says that any American soldier, any troops in the Philippines, they're not under the jurisdiction of Filipino law. They're under the jurisdiction of the United States law. So that especially came into play just most recently. It was early in January, I think January 18th of this year. The U.S. refused to hand over five soldiers accused of rape, gang rape of a Filipino woman, close to a military base, close to, I think it was a naval base. And this led to massive demonstrations. And, you know, it's basically a breach of sovereignty. You know, how can you call this country a sovereign country? And you have the United States basically doing whatever it wants in terms of its soldiers just being there and, you know, also polluting the country and not just also harassing the individuals there. So that's one aspect of the Philippines I think it's important to know is that the U.S. is still very much its colonial daddy. It has been historically and continues to be this day.
Okay, I don't want to take you off your track, but I just want to ask a follow-up question on that.
Because
I know we've got 3 points you want to make there. But
Have
there been, to your knowledge, any instances where the Philippines have pushed back on that agreement and said, we don't want to, this isn't working for us?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's a great question, because that brings me to another point where in the Philippines, there's currently a very popular movement towards true self-determination and towards a government that's truly accountable to its people. So there's an organization called BAYAN that exists in the Philippines, and you know, BAYAN has its roots in the struggle against Marcos. Hopefully most of your listeners know Ferdinand Marcos was one of the most brutal and extreme dictators of the Philippines. And there was a peaceful people power revolution. I believe it was in 1986, the people power revolution of 86, where he was finally overthrown, and it was a peaceful revolution. And it was through the work of such organizations like BAYAN, and BAYAN is a Tagalog word that means like nation or people. People of a nation.
That's BAYAN, right?
B as in boy, AYAN, correct. Yeah, it was the work of this organization to bring people into the streets, into, as they call, the parliament of the streets, to oust Marcos as the U.S.-backed dictator and exile him to Hawaii. So BAYAN, let me just go a little bit more into it, is a multi-sectoral collection of individuals that fights for national democracy. So it fights for, or it struggles for, it organizes for a government that's truly accountable to the people. And when I say sectoral, I mean that it organizes youths as a sector, workers as a sector, women, any kind of social identifier, you know, any type of identifying thing that people consider themselves a part of, that's how they organize people. You know, so farmers, peasants, indigenous folks, all they have all these different organizations within Bayan that kind of tout the Bayan line, which is very simple. It's, you know, true freedom, a Philippine government that's not a colonial ward of the United States, you know, U.S. troops out of the Philippines, and they also are fighting for a kind of a European-style socialist perspective, you know, like free healthcare for everybody, guaranteed free education to its citizens, you know, nationalization of industries, you know, things that will benefit the people and things that are possible because the Philippines is so rich in natural resources. So that's the above-ground organizing that happens. That's buy-in, and that's very, very strong, very powerful, and they do a lot to mobilize people in the streets for parliamentary reform, etc. So that's one aspect. And they have been especially, especially strong in resisting these things like the and bringing to light internationally things like human rights violations and the situation of the woman who was raped, gang raped by the American soldiers, etc. So that's buy-in, and I actually do a lot of work and network a lot with buy-in organizations. And PUSO is actually working to become a buy-in organization because even though it's based out of the Philippines, it has anywhere there's Filipinos, you can create like a buy-in organization. So there's a buy-in USA, and there's buy-in organizations all around the United States that are supporting the popular struggle in the Philippines toward parliamentary reform and towards you know, government that's truly accountable to the people. So that's buy-in, and then a separate from buy-in and a completely separate plane of existence, I guess you'd say, is that is I think a lot of your viewers probably don't know is that there's a civil war in the Philippines that has been going on since the 1960s, since about 1968, and that was also coincides with the Marcos era. The Marcos era was so brutal and so so dictatorial, obviously, that it resulted in two struggles: an above ground struggle that was fighting for reform and that was, you know, fighting for a into the legal system. It also started an underground civil war, and that was basically the NPA, the New People's Army. And they're not really based in the cities, you know, this whole thing of parliamentary reform, that's all about, you know, mobilizing people in the cities and inviting your congressperson and, you know, demonstrations and stuff. But this civil war thing, that was going on in the countryside, and that was basically organizing peasants to help defend, you know, defend themselves against a lot of the corporations and mining interests that were coming in and brutalizing the farmers. Because, you know, I mean, the countryside is very lawless. You know, that Wild West mentality you get in the United States where, you know, it's untamed? I mean, that's kind of how it is in the Philippines in the countryside. There's, you know, basically whoever has the biggest and most guns wins. And in the countryside, the folks with the biggest and most guns are the hired thugs and the paramilitary forces of corporations who are trying to, you know, get resources and or mine the mountains or pollute rivers and dam rivers. They have the guns and the numbers, and of course they usually have the backing of the Philippine Armed Forces, so the military themselves. And so the NPA is very active in the countryside in defending the indigenous peoples and the peasants and helping them organize for their interests and for their ancestral lands and for their rights. But I just need to emphasize again, the NPA is completely separate from the above-ground organizing that's happening. Two different things. The above-ground recognizes that, you know, some people will, you know, will reach a limit and will, you know, do that kind of struggle and will enter into that kind of war, but it's not their thing. It's not the principle of the buy-in. And so,
I would guess that MPA that mm-hmm. these are the people that are, given the way things are going in this day and age, the Philippine government and probably also the U.S. government would brand them as terrorists.
Oh, yes. They are. Actually, the New People's Army has the official United States brand of terrorist organization.
Okay.
And I think that happened 2 years ago when Colin Powell visited the Philippines, and after he visited the Philippines and talked to the current president, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, who I'll talk about later, mm-hmm. after he talked with her, he left, and the NPA got that official branding. And so now that kind of gives the United States free rein to send all kinds of aid to the Philippines, more military, more guns, more mm-hmm. training to stamp out this terrorist organization. And you know how, I mean, I know this may seem a little like a far metaphor, but you know how Tibet has, you know, its own government in India, like mm-hmm. has a government in exile. Well, outside the Philippines, stationed in the Netherlands, that's where the National Democratic Front of the Philippines, or the underground forces, are also located. So that's like a shadow government, basically.
And where is that again?
That's in Utrecht, Netherlands.
Really?
Yeah, where Jose Maria Sison, who is a very influential figure and who was one of the founders of the MPA and of the Communist Party of the Philippines, you know, he is based in the Netherlands. And so that's, you know, its own government that's waging a legitimate war according to a United Nations agreement on civil wars. You know, that's where they're based. But because of this terrorist, label, they're actually struggling a lot in Europe in terms of being recognized mm-hmm. as a warring party, you know.
Interesting. So
there are agreements. There are, I can't think of them off the top of my head, but there are specific UN agreements that govern and that kind of legislate the behavior of warring parties, you know, in a civil war.
Right.
And that's kind of blown out of the water when you have the U.S. saying that they're, instead of being a legitimate warring party, are saying that they're a terrorist organization, you know.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
I think you made the three points. I don't want to, again, I don't want to take you off your track. But
sure.
So
sure.
How does this, can you relate this specifically to Surigao? And I would think that it'd be good to tell us a bit specifically about that, if it's a province, I believe, right?
Surigao. Actually, there's two Surigaos in the Philippines. So if you're imagining the Philippines, or if you're looking at the Philippines on a map, you'll see a big island on the top and another big island on the bottom, and kind of like a middle part with tons of other islands.
Mm-hmm.
And Surigao is in the bottom island, the bottom big island, which is the island known as Mindanao.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the, northeast region,
mm-hmm.
Northeast province. And that there's Surigao del Norte and Surigao del Sur, North and South Surigao.
All right.
And this is part of a region called the Caraga region in northeast Mindanao that includes Agusan del Sur and Sur and Agusan del Norte.
Okay.
So those four provinces are all in that area. The reason why this province was chosen by the International Solidarity Mission conveners was because there's this particular region of Mindanao has one of the highest populations of indigenous peoples in Mindanao, or Lumad is the Visayan word for the indigenous individuals there. And they call themselves the Manobos. Manobos is the proper noun, it's the proper term to use for these particular Lumad populations. And so the highest concentration of these individuals is in this valley called the Andat Valley. And as we all know, valleys are immensely rich in minerals, fertile lands, or the areas between mountains, so all the runoff goes in there. And so these lands have been the ancestral lands of the Manobos for, you know, hundreds of years. You know, people have been on the Philippines for a long time. And their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were farming this land. And unfortunately, because it's so rich in natural resources, it's a great boon for them as farmers and as peasants, but it's also something of interest to mining corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in the 1950s, large mining companies and corporations have basically operated throughout this province, especially in the Andat Valley, which has the Manobos people. But in 1984, the corporations there had said, quote, that there was an unstable peace and order situation in the area, and they said it was due to the New People's Army. And the New People's Army, you know, in that region had consistently opposed large-scale mining. You know, and I'm not just talking about, you know, little miners going in with pickaxes and just kind of chipping away at rock. I'm talking, like, big mining operations. Like, we're talking ones that destroy mountains, you know, mm-hmm. that use cyanide to leach the materials off of the rocks.
Right.
Which creates runoff that they keep in these, you know, holding pools. And these holding pools, because they're so flimsily constructed, have been known to break, especially if you investigate a lot of the mining companies up in the north.
Mm-hmm.
They break, release a lot of cyanide into the water, and destroy all the life in the water, and pretty much, like, force whole villages off of the rivers because mm-hmm. the water is no longer drinkable. So, we're talking large-scale mining. And the New People's Army had opposed them because of this large-scale mining. This large-scale mining, you know, pollutes the rivers, it pushes people off of land, and, you know, it pollutes and destroys the ancestral lands that these Manobos folks have been on for hundreds of years. So the New People's Army was in the area, like, in the 1980s, and the mining corporations had left. And, I don't remember the names of the mining corporations at that time,
mm-hmm.
but I do know that Bencor is one that's especially popular now. And I was looking up Bencor on the internet, you know, and I couldn't find, you know, it's one of those sneaky shadow companies, I guess, because, you know, the word on the ground in the Philippines is that it's a consortium of, like, individuals from the Middle East, United States, Canada, and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no specific documentation about that. But I'm jumping ahead. So you know, for a while it was okay. You know, the MPA was active in the area. They created an environment that was unstable for the mining interest. The mining interest left, but all of that changed in 1995, and that was the Mining Act of 1995. And basically, it was an act that was passed by Congress that was that liberalized land rights in the Philippines. And it's a very long, you can find it on the internet, it's a very long document. You can just Google Mining Act of 1995, Philippines. And it basically opened up vast areas of the Philippine countryside to large-scale mining operations, or, you know, open-pit mines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, of course, Bayan made a big fuss about it, and they brought the case, you know, the law, you know, all the way to the Supreme Court. And so it was kind of in flux. From 1995 to 2004, the legitimacy and the legality of the Mining Act of 1995 was kind of in question. They didn't really know, you know, about how that's going to be. So finally and unfortunately, in December 1st, 2004, the Supreme Court of the Philippines upheld the Mining Act. Basically said that it was a constitutional act and that there wasn't any kind of contradiction between the act and the constitution and the interests of the government. So that was quite sad. So that officially put the act in the law, and as I said before, opened up vast areas of the Philippine countryside to large-scale mining and other types of resource extraction
mm-hmm.
Operations. And
so you said 2004.
Yeah, that was 2004 that happened.
All right.
Once that happened, they started taking applications for different areas in the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
and basically the government responsible for the land permits were flooded with permit applications, and the biggest corporation was, as I said before, Bencor. And Bencor, you know, as soon as the Mining Act was declared constitutional, they put out a statement that they would revitalize its operations in the Andot Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so they started moving, you know, I mean, they haven't started moving their equipment yet, but they started buying up permits for lands, which, of course, happened to be homes of these Manobos people. Right. Of course, no one's consulting the Manobos about this. No one's saying to the Manobos, oh, by the way, we're going to take your land away from you and you're going to have to go someplace else. You know, these things all happen, you know, in the governments without any kind of accountability to any of the folks who are already there. It's really frustrating. And so what they saw happen in last year, in 2005, was they saw a large influx of the military in the Ondot Valley. There's been basically massive military operations. And, I mean, a lot of the operations have its roots back to the 80s, you know, where there are always military in the area, and the military was always there due to other things too, like supposedly finding the Abu Sayyaf terrorist organization or Muslim extremists or whatever. But this time, you know, there's no reason for them to be there in the area. There's no terrorist organizations they can point to. There's no, you know, there's no bandits in the area, you know, they're just there, you know, and they're not saying why, they're just there. But, you know, everyone knows why. They're there because, you know, of the Mining Act, and because Bencor specifically said they want the place safe for its operations.
Right.
And so the military moves in, and their operations, when I say military operations, I mean like drills, like shooting off cannons, like, you know, evacuating villages so that the army can use them as barracks. You know, things of that nature started happening in the 1990s. You know, so there was recurring evacuations. You know, they'd go into a village, they'd evacuate into the larger municipalities, not really cities, because in that area there are no big cities like you see in Manila or Quezon City or Davao, but the larger municipalities, like in between a, you know, big city and a little village.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would flood into these municipalities, and then the military would do their thing, and then the military would leave, and then slowly they'd go back to their villages, and then the military would come back. And, you know, this was a recurring pattern in the 1990s, 1980s to 1990s, you know, and that continued to this day. And so this led to a lot of the, you know, smaller elected officials in the area to declare, you know, these areas as like zones of peace. You know, in the early 1990s, that was a big thing, a zone of peace. Come on, let's not have these military operations here. Let's leave the people alone.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the atrocities continue.
Right.
You know, from that. And so what the villages started doing, the villages, the Manobos started doing, was they started becoming more united in their opposition. You know, more villages started talking to each other and saying, hey, is this happening to you? Yeah. This is happening to me. Did that happen to you? Yeah. And so they started forming these organizations. One such organization is called MAPASU, and it stands for Malahutayong Pagig Bisog Alang Sa Sumusunod, which means persevering struggle for the next generation. Now, my Visayan is really bad. Visayan is a dialect in the South, so sorry. My apologies to any of you listeners who are Visayan. And so MAPASU, for short, is a group that, you know, started introducing programs such as literacy, education, being knowledgeable about government and organizing so that they can, you know, they can peacefully assert their rights to self-determination, you know, on their ancestral lands. But the military saw that, you know, the military saw this organizing that was happening and saw that they were calling them cooperatives, and the military immediately began saying, oh, you guys are New People's Army, because only the New People Army uses things like cooperatives and collectives, and only the underground groups would do something like that. And so, you know, the military started saying, look, the villagers are becoming NPA, and that's when the military operation started to intensify, like, really, really badly. And that's when local human rights organizations started documenting immense human rights abuses at that time, especially from April to May of 2005, which is just last year, just
right.
Very recently.
Well, we are unfortunately coming up close to a half an hour here.
And
and I mean, there's obviously a lot of information. Really appreciate the history,
sure,
especially of how this all ties together. It's like the other interviews I've done. I sort of demands a follow-up, because I try not to get it too long so people will actually listen to it. I guess if we could just end with more, just a little bit more specifics for folks on. I know there are, of course, human rights violations that are going on. What kinds of things are the Philippine military doing in?
Sure. So I can go into more about what was happening from April to May of 2005.
Okay.
At that time, they actually started full-scale bombings. During that time, last year, affecting five towns, they basically started bombing these defenseless villages. These are basically villages where, you know, the most dangerous weapon they have is, you know, the reapers or, you know, the machetes to get through the brush, right? And so they started bombing these villages, and that led to massive, like, it wasn't just, you know, some people leaving. It was everyone leaving, and they just absolutely flooded the municipalities of Surigao. And so it displaced more than 2,241 million civilians from...
Whoa, say that again?
2,241 civilians were displaced from these municipalities. And these are from, you know, these are divided up between 15 communities in Surigao, and they all went to the bigger municipalities. And as you can imagine, that many people in a municipality that maybe only had, you know, 500 people before, oof, that was intense. So, you know, now it wasn't just the evacuees, the refugees who were, you know, totally out of it, but it was also the, you know, the municipalities that had their resources strained beyond what their normal capacity is. And so that was one thing. The other thing was that the military started brutally, physically assaulting and threatening not just the male farmers, but little children. I'm going to tell you one story of this youth. His name is Jesse Bacosmas. All right, Jesse is, at the time of the attack, he was 10 years old. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Jason Escalso. That's the name that I'm thinking of. Jason Escalso. He's 10 years old. On the morning of April 30th of last year, he was working with his family in the fields, and they were confronted by a few armed soldiers. I think they were like 14. And the men were separated from the women and children, you know, at gunpoint. Soldiers all had these big guns, U.S.-issued guns. And the soldiers were threatening the group of women and children. They were telling them they were going to mutilate them, and that they were going to, and then they started interrogating the men by beating them. All right? And so they specifically also started beating on the children. And, you know, they were beating them and saying, tell us where the MPA is. We know your MPA. Where's the MPA? And, you know, they have no idea. I mean, the MPA hasn't been there in years, since like the 80s. So they have no idea. And so Jason Escalso, you know, in a really immense and just sad and emotional recounting of his tale to us while we were there for the mission, told us about how he was beaten. They were beaten by the blunt edges of the military knives, you know, the big military, like Rambo, like military knives that they have. They're beating them with the blunt ends. It was Jason, 10-year-old, he's 10 years old, him and two other teenagers. And so... And then they were instructed to dig these holes. You know, Jason and these two kids, they were instructed to dig these holes with their bare hands. And after, you know, an hour or so after they were digging, they were commanded by the soldiers to sit in these holes. And the soldiers had told them that they had just dug their own graves and that now they were going to die in the graves that they had just dug. I mean, this is just, I'm sitting there just blown away by what was being translated to me by this 10-year-old kid. Well, now he's 11. But at the time, was 10 years old. So the military started swinging their knives around the children's backs as they lay crying in the graves, as if to finally kill them. But instead they ended up just torturing them more, beating them in the holes. You know, it was psychological torture for their mothers who were there. And after about 2 hours of this, the military finally released everyone. But, you know, imagine a 10-year-old kid, 10 years old, and experiencing that, you know, experiencing soldiers coming in, you know, physically abusing everyone, and then telling you you're going to die after you've just dug your own grave. Oh, man. So that story specifically, you know, just really hit me as to how extreme the human rights situation is in the Philippines, and how, you know, the current president, President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, who is actually, you know, a sort of a legal president. You can Google her and see that there's a lot of election scandal, which of course this country is no stranger to. There's a lot of election scandal around her presidency, and you know she's the commander in chief of the Philippine Armed Forces, just like the U.S. president is of his. And so, you know, she needs to be held accountable for all of these extreme human rights violations that are being done in her name or in the name of the government. And so that was really horrific for me.
Right. Well, it is horrifying, and it's all these things add up. With the four provinces that I've been able to talk to people about, who have visited during the International Solidarity Mission, as part of that last summer, and I'm sure there's much more. There's much, much more to this.
Oh yeah.
And I'll just because we do need to wrap it up, I'll just ask you finally, as I've asked others, do you have plans at this point to go back to the Philippines?
Yes. You know, as dangerous and as emotional as it was, you know, I do want to go back. You know, because living in the United States, you know, in the diaspora of Filipinos here and all over the world, I think all of us have an accountability to the people we've left behind. I think we all, you know, part of our Filipino heritage is organizing, is resistance, is making a Philippines that is better for everyone, for our children and for our children's children, and for, you know, my family members who I haven't even seen for years. Like my responsibility to them is to help make that vision of a free Philippines possible. And so I am interested in going back to the Philippines. I probably will go back this summer, and I will. I'm not going to be a part of the official fact-finding team, but I do want to do a follow-up to see, you know, how are people, what has happened to Jason, and what has happened to the families of individuals who have lost, you know, the men of the families, you know, and have lost very important family members who were responsible for, you know, the cultivation of the crops and sustaining the family. I want to know, you know, what happened to these towns.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope we get a chance to talk to you again.
Oh, sure, yeah, I hope so.
If not before you go back, but maybe after you go back, or who knows? Maybe even while you're there, that would be fantastic.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, that'd be great if that could happen. Oh. I just want to point out just two quick statistics before I go.
Okay.
Okay. In 2004, there are 570 cases of human rights violations that affected 9,924 individuals.
Uh-huh.
Okay, 9,924. In 2005, for the whole month, from January to December of that year, there were 874 cases, all right? Instead of 570, there were 874 cases of human rights violations that victimized over 99,000 individuals, all right? So we went in 1 year alone, we went from 9,924 to 99,000 individuals. So that's 100% increase between those 2 years alone. And, you know, if that's the kind of increase between 2004 and 2005, I'm really terrified.
You have to be concerned about what's happening.
I'm really terrified for 2006.
Right, and has been, I think, very appropriately named, not the war against terror, but the war of terror.
It is the war of terror.
Right.
It's true, especially in the Philippines, in the countryside especially.
Okay, well, Joaquin, I really appreciate your sharing this information and your time with us. And,
yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yes, and keep up the good fight, and hopefully we can get this out, and we'll have some folks learning a little bit, and if not, acting a lot. And do you have any contact information you want to share before we close?
Yeah, sure. The organization I'm a member of is called PUSO, Philippine-U.S. Solidarity Organization. We have an email that you can get a hold of us at, and that you can join our list. So you can find out more about what's going on in the Philippines, and that's PUSO or PUSO 2004 at yahoo.com.
Okay.
I believe is the one that other folks in my organization have been giving out.
That sounds right. Yep.
That's the one I'm going to use.
Okay. Well, thank you again. And if you don't mind, would you hang on the line?
Of course.
And just to wrap it up and I'll just tell people that this is Scott Perguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and we've been talking to Joaquin Hui of Philippine-U.S. Solidarity Organization. He's out of Seattle, and about the Philippines in general and Surigao Province in specific. Thank you for listening.